Hi, welcome to Forever Paranormal with Dr. Bill and Deb. The term paranormal refers to phenomena and experiences that are beyond the scope of normal scientific understanding and cannot be easily explained through traditional scientific principles. These phenomena often challenge conventional beliefs and are associated with the supernatural, metaphysical, or unexplained aspects of reality. As with any field of inquiry, it is essential to approach the paranormal with an open but critical mind, relying on empirical evidence and logical reasoning to draw conclusions. It's a topic that continues to intrigue and challenge both believers and skeptics alike, and if we can connect a paranormal element to it, we'll talk about it. You'll be surprised by what all can be connected to the paranormal. Please don't forget to follow, rate, and share the show, since it would not be possible without you, our listeners. And as a public service, we would like to let everyone know that you are truly never alone, even if you think you are. The Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is 988. Please just reach out. Well, hello there, and welcome to this week's episode, where we are going to chew on a small buffet of some terrifying and weird tales. Or maybe they are just weirdly terrifying. We'll let you decide. Hi, Deb.
Hi.
Well, I'm glad to see you're not yumbling today.
Oh, boy.
Folks, in case you're wondering what yumbling is, it's apparently a cross between yelling at someone while mumbling at the same time, which is purportedly something I totally excel at.
Well, sometimes.
Okay, enough with the unorthodox English lesson. So what excitement did you bring us this week, Deb?
Well, I searched far and wide for a good news story, but to no avail. There are so many stories of death, destruction, backstabbing, and lies, it is so hard to go out the door every day with a smile. Listeners, let me tell you, for the last year, we have stopped watching the local news first thing in the morning for this very reason. Then we stopped watching the evening news religiously. And folks, I have to say it has been a successful experiment of sorts. I don't know about you, Bill, but the outlook for each day for me seems to be more positive.
Well, you know, I have to agree with that. We do a puzzle together and we talk in the morning and we get ready for work and we go to work. It is completely positive.
Yeah. The morning news created a stressful start to each day. Now we do a check-in on occasion to see the weather forecast and catch some headlines. I mean, we don't want to be clueless if the end of the world is really, truly near. Not surprisingly, though, the top stories we catch are about a new, different subject, and yet they are basically the same doom and gloom stories. So, testimonial aside, if you are looking to start your days off on a brighter note, give this a try, if watching or reading the news is your thing.
You know, that's a really great point, and I'm glad you brought that up, because I didn't realize till just now when you discussed this what a positive impact it has definitely had on our lives the last year.
Yeah.
It really has. Thank you for reminding me of that. That's really great. I appreciate that.
Of course.
All right, so speaking of doom and gloom, let's go ahead and get this one started with the Villisca Axe Murder House in Villisca, Iowa. In case you aren't aware, this is the site where in 1912, six children and two adults were brutally murdered by having their skulls crushed in with an axe, and it's purportedly extremely haunted. Josiah Moore, his wife Sarah, and their four children, along with two family guests, the Stillinger sisters, were the victims. Here's what we know about the killings. The doctors concluded that the murders had taken place between midnight and 5 a.m. Two cigarette butts in the attic suggested that the killer or killers patiently waited until the Moore family and the Stillinger guests were asleep. The killing started in the master bedroom, where Josiah and Sarah Moore were sleeping. Josiah received more blows from the axe than any other victim. His face had been cut to such an extent that his eyes were even missing. The ceiling in the room also had a gouge mark from when the murderer lifted the axe while chopping him up and hit the ceiling with it. At 7 a.m. the next day, June 10th, Mary Peckham, the Moore's neighbor, became concerned after she noticed that the family had not come out to do their morning chores. Peckham knocked on the Moore's door. When nobody answered, she tried to open the door and discovered it was locked. Peckham went ahead and let the Moore's chickens out to eat and called Ross Moore, Josiah's brother. Like Peckham, Moore received no response when he knocked on the door and shouted. Ross unlocked the front door with his copy of the house key, while Peckham stood on the porch. Ross went into the parlor and opened the guest bedroom door, where he found Ina and Lena Stillinger's bodies on the bed. Moore immediately told Peckham to call Henry Hank Horton, Villisca's primary peace officer, who arrived shortly thereafter. Horton's search of the house revealed that the entire Moore family and the two Stillinger girls had been bludgeoned to death. The murder weapon, an axe belonging to Josiah himself, was found in the guest room where the Stillinger sisters were found. The killer or killers used the blade of the axe on Sarah while using the blunt end on the rest of the victims. Wow. Herman, Mary Catherine, Arthur, and Paul, who were the Moore children, were next bludgeoned in the head in the same manner as their parents. Afterwards, the murderer returned to the master bedroom to inflict more blows on the elder Moores, knocking over a shoe that filled with blood before moving downstairs to the guest bedroom and killing Ina and Lena. This next piece makes no sense to me at all, but it's reported that after the killings, a 4-pound slab of bacon was taken out of the icebox and laid next to the axe. Investigators also found untouched food and bloody water during the search, like he had washed up. After the search, people were let in to see if they could have committed the crime, which completely contaminated the weapon and all the evidence. There were multiple suspects in the case, from a senator all the way down to a traveling reverend, George Kelly, who ended up being tried twice for the murders, with the first trial ending in a hung jury, and the second ended up with him being acquitted. Apparently, the case and trial were so convoluted that according to an article in the Ogden Standard newspaper on Tuesday, November 17th, H.M. Havner, who was Iowa's attorney general, was charged with oppression of office for how badly it was handled. I'm not exactly sure what the charge of oppression of office means, but it was bad because he was no longer attorney general. And the case is still unsolved, but it's weird on how this was the last of a series of axe murders across several states at the time. During the 2 years leading up to this incident, there were similar murders carried out in Colorado Springs, Ellsworth, Kansas, Paola, Kansas, and Guilford, Missouri, and then finally ending with the one here in Iowa. I don't know about anyone else, but it makes me wonder if anyone ever bothered checking out the whereabouts of the traveling Reverend Kelly when these other murders occurred. I mean, here is what we know about Kelly, who was described as being peculiar, reportedly having suffered a mental breakdown as an adolescent, and then as an adult, he was accused of peeping and several times for asking young women and girls to pose nude for him. This was definitely a very religious traveling reverend, wasn't it? Then on June 8th, 1912, he came to Villisca to teach at the Children's Day Services, which the Moore family attended on June 9, 1912. He left town between 5 a.m. and 5:50 a.m. on June 10, 1912, just hours before the bodies were discovered. Reverend Kelly had actually confessed to the murders during hours of harsh interrogation, but later recanted. In 1914, 2 years after the murders, Kelly was arrested for sending obscene material through the mail. he apparently was sexually harassing a woman who had applied for a job as his secretary. He was sent to St. Elizabeth's Hospital, the National Mental Hospital in Washington, D.C. Investigators speculated again that Kelly could be the murderer of the Moore family. But remember, he was tried twice and finally acquitted. They can't try him again. So what about the house today, though? The house changed hands a few times over the past 100 years, and the reported ghost encounters just keep accumulating. Things like disembodied giggles and screams, unexplained movements, a strange fog moving from room to room when the train passes through the town, along with strange behavior from visitors that indicate the possibility of possessions, are just some of the activities that indicate a paranormal presence at the Villisca Axe Murder House. Turns out Darwin and Martha Lynn bought the three-bedroom farmhouse in 1994, which they planned to turn into a historical museum. The Lynns wanted to revive the home and bring it back to its former glory to function as an interactive time capsule and a glimpse into what domestic life was like for the average Midwestern family in the early 20th century. Apparently, the house had more to say, though, and the Lynns were ready to listen. Soon after the Lynns bought the home, they got an influx of requests from some unexpected inquirers. Paranormal investigators who wanted to visit the house to commune with the ghost. I wonder if they wanted to sit around a campfire and sing Kumbaya, but anyhow, they were interested in the deceased victims that once lived there. While the couple hadn't even heard of this profession, they quickly realized that little white Villisca farmhouse, possibly the most familiar-looking house in the most familiar-looking town in the country, was definitely haunted, and that the museum should reflect its deep, dark history. Today, the Villisca Axe Murder House serves as a paranormal hotel, where groups of six or fewer can pay $428 to book the house overnight. Accommodations, though, are sparse. In fact, it's recommended that guests pack their own sleeping bag. Not that they'll be getting much sleep, though. When you rent the house, the owner simply hands the keys to the guest when they arrive and then leaves them alone for the night. But that's the real key. They probably won't be alone if it's really as haunted as it is rumored to be. You know, Deb, a case like this almost makes me feel bad for the spirits who are being exploited for someone else's bank account. Do you get any feedback on this?
Yeah, lots. So let's discuss. I assume the lurid details of the Reverend's past did not come out until after the murders?
Correct.
It sounds like the investigative techniques lacked experience. I mean, if they tested people to see if they could use the axe to kill someone, they could have at least used a similar one, don't you think?
I agree with that, too.
And I'm guessing the cigarette butts were a clue and the missing eyeballs. If all cylinders were not firing on the Reverend, was his home searched for any trophies?
He didn't have a home. He was a traveling Reverend.
So he, had a carriage that he lived in?
I'm not sure what he lived in. It never went into any details about that.
Okay. Any idea where the eyeballs are?
No, they were in the house. They just weren't in his head.
I see. Now, it sounds like Sarah was the main target, given she got the blade, not the handle. And she was the only one who got the blade, right?
Right, from the report, yes.
I just wonder if she rebuffed him over the course of his visit in town, and that's what prompted this. I mean, I agree with you about the bacon, too. Have there been any reports of contact with the victims by any of the visiting paranormal investigators?
There's all kinds of reports of contacts, and even your big shows nowadays have visited this house.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there are a couple points where one of the things that the Attorney General got in trouble for is a private investigator got involved in this,
mm-hmm,
because the Reverend was writing letters like crazy to the police department, asking all kinds of questions. And the private investigator started asking the Reverend questions about the murder. And the Reverend was able to answer him and stuff. And so he went to sneak into whatever the Reverend, wherever he was, the mm-hmm. next town over, whatever. And the Attorney General had him arrested for breaking and entering when he was going to get the evidence against the Reverend. So it looks like the Reverend probably was the murderer, but no one really knows for sure. It's just really a screwed up deal.
Yeah.
I know. Wow. All right, so here's another weirdly terrifying or terrifyingly weird tale. This one comes from KPRC News in Houston. When you think of haunted dolls, it's likely the creepy old Victorian-looking porcelain kind that springs to mind, or the Raggedy Ann kind, none of which you probably have laying around. Still, don't get too comfortable around any kid's toys too soon. A Disney's Frozen Elsa doll that was given as a Christmas gift in 2013 in the Houston area made headlines earlier that year when it seemingly became haunted. The doll recited phrases from the movie Frozen and sang, "Let it go," when a button on its necklace was pressed. For 2 years, it did that in English, Mother Emily Madonia said. In 2015, it started doing it alternating between Spanish and English. There wasn't a button that changed these. It was just random. There was no language selector. The family has owned the doll for more than 6 years and never, ever changed its batteries. The mother says the doll would randomly begin to speak and sing even with its switch turned off. I don't know if they ever removed the batteries, though. The family decided to throw the creepy doll out in December of 2019. Weeks later, they found it inside a bench in their living room. The kids insisted that they didn't put it there, and I believed them because they wouldn't have dug through the garbage outside, their mother said. At that point, Elsa ceased to sing the English rendition of Let It Go altogether, speaking only in Spanish when pressed. The family then double-bagged the bizarre doll and placed it at the bottom of their garbage, which was taken out on garbage day and picked up by the garbage truck. Then they went on a short trip afterwards, but when they returned, Elsa, too, had come back and was waiting in the backyard of their home. This time, though, the family mailed Elsa to a family friend in Minnesota who taped the haunted doll to the front bumper of his truck. It doesn't seem to have made its way back to Houston yet, but apparently there is a Facebook page out there somewhere where you can check on the doll's current location. But you gotta wonder how many looks this guy gets driving around town in Minnesota with this doll tied to the front of his truck. Well, definitely not as demonic as Annabelle, but still creepy as hell. I mean, the movie Frozen is a weird story for children on its own right. Deb, any comments? Because I know haunted objects have a tendency to creep you out a little.
Well, my initial thought was the doll has some sort of hackable computer chip in it. But then that does not explain how it continued to sing without changing batteries. Those surely died long before they got rid of the doll. And it kept reappearing, which is creepy. I wonder, though, what has kept it from returning from Minnesota?
Maybe because it's still taped to the front of the truck and can't get loose. I don't know. That is kind of wild. And, yeah, you're right about the batteries because, you know, when the kids were young and the toys, we went through batteries.
Mm-hmm.
We should have had stock in Duracell, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah.
That's for sure about the batteries. All right. So here's one, though, from 2015 in Auburn, Pennsylvania. This is when the Bretzus family decided they needed to upgrade the insulation in the walls of their house. Well, it appears that the walls were already filled to the brim. Not with insulation, though, but with dead animal carcasses that were filled and covered in spice and wrapped in newspapers from the 1930s and 40s. Of course, the authorities were called and the items were removed, with hundreds of them being sent to some type of expert in Kutztown, Pennsylvania. The expert attributed the mummified animals in the walls to what is known as powwow, or Dutch magic, a ritual originating in the culture of the Pennsylvania Dutch to treat ailments and gain physical and spiritual protection. But let's not confuse this with the powwows that so many indigenous people take part in. The Pennsylvania Dutch were a group of German-speaking settlers to Pennsylvania in the 16 and 1700s and are often of Lutheran, Mennonite, or Amish faiths. The Lancaster Sunday News did an extensive story on March 23, 1952 Sunday edition about the powwows and practitioners after two men were convicted of practicing medicine without a license for healing burns and warts. So what is powwow or powwowing, you ask? Powwow, also known as brahe, in the Pennsylvania Dutch language, is a vernacular system of North American traditional medicine and folk magic originating in the culture of the Pennsylvania Dutch. It blends elements of religion and belief with health and healing, and includes a wide range of healing rituals and chants used primarily for treating ailments in humans and livestock, as well as securing physical and spiritual protection and good luck in everyday affairs. These rituals are used for healing the body, protection from physical and spiritual harm, and ensuring good outcomes in normal everyday affairs. But it has a darker side, with spells and traditions of placing hexes and even ways to conjure demons to do your bidding for you. Powwowing's origins are as far back as mankind, but today's origins are typically credited to a book written by George Homan called The Long Lost Friend, which was first published in 1819. And until then, everything about spell work was passed down from generation to generation. This one, many times written about witchcraft and hexes, you know, it's all kinds of things out there about it now, but that was the original. I wonder if the Bretsu's family had any issues with their home after removing the items, which I assume to have had protection spells cast over them. I personally have multiple copies of this book in digital form and always have a copy with me. I also carry many spells from this book on my person, and I can tell you that it definitely works, as I have healed and conjured from it and have seen it done by a few others. The weirdest part of powwowing is it involves everything from the Holy Bible to written hexes and symbols in the practice. I mean, after all, Psalms is said to be a book of spells in the Bible. Deb, what's your thoughts on this? And how do you think you would rank this on the Osborne's willy-nilly scale?
I don't know how to rate it on that scale, and here's why. As you know, in the isolated area I grew up in, there were lots of people of this same origin. Most are nice enough if you come in contact, but that is to say they are cordial. They have their beliefs and their own ways, as do we all. The ritual itself seems to be no different than the rituals of a medicine man or the practices of a doctor in modern medicine. I can respect that to a point.
I do too. And, you know, like I said, I do have the book. I do use it. So we're going to leave it go with that.
Okay. Right?
But because I think if I stop talking on that right now, we'll have time to squeeze one more weird and terrifying tale in to close out this episode. What do you think? Should we do one more?
Go for it.
All right. Here is something that is truly terrifying, especially if you're a parent. This is the headline from the Tampa Bay News dated June 14, 2012, and it reads, "Woman arrested on child abuse charges after bizarre cutting and burning ritual." Wow, okay. It seems Danielle Harkins told the kids they needed to rid their bodies of demons as the group gathered before dusk Saturday around a small fire near the pier of St. Petersburg. "They should cut their skin to let the evil spirits out," police said she told the children. "Then they needed to burn the wounds to ensure that those spirits would not return." It turns out Harkins was a literacy teacher at Leoman and Asian Neighborhood Family Center. As a literacy specialist, Harkins taught reading and writing skills to the center's clients for about 4.5 years. So that's why it's terrifying as a parent to think that a teacher is doing this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this woman was a teacher who was trusted with the safety of someone's children. Okay, so I don't get it. Her way of saving the kids is to cut them open and then save them with fire and seal them? A real big WTF moment here for me, let me tell you. The police report said the ritual was attended by 7 teenagers, all of Asian ethnic background, whom Harkins had taught a few years ago in her job at the center. At least 2 were injured, police said, but none of the teens told their parents about the incident. Police investigated after one of the teens, a 16-year-old boy, sent a text message about the incident to a friend. The friend told the boy's parents, who then notified the police. In interviews with detectives, the teens were reluctant to talk about the ritual beyond the basic facts of what happened. They did reveal a few things, however. When Harkins held a lighter to one teen's hand, wind blew the flame out, police said. So then, that prompted her to douse the kid's hand in perfume before setting it afire. The boy suffered second-degree burns. Another teen was cut on the neck with a broken bottle. Harkins then used the flame to heat a small key, which she used to cauterize the wound. Wow. No one really knows what the motivation behind all this was, but court records and a neighbor do give us some clues. Harkins recently divorced her husband, George. They had had 2 children, a 4-year-old daughter and a 3-year-old son, who, seems clear now, was under the father's custody. It was about a month after the divorce that she reportedly started to act a little off, if you know what I mean. Records do show that Harkins was the defendant in a sexual violence injunction that was dismissed in January, and then in August that year, she filed a domestic violence injunction against her husband, which was also dismissed. Lisa Cope, Harkins' next-door neighbor for the previous 4 years, said the last time she saw her, Harkins had taken an interest in some pretty bizarre and extreme religious beliefs. "She was my friend," Cope said. "She cried on my shoulder when her and her husband were getting a divorce." Cope said that she didn't know what to make of her neighbor's newfound religious interest, though, but she did say, "Harkins told me I was okay. She said I didn't have any demons." So then, in a later interview with NBC News, Harkins did allude to the idea that she was purging demons from others, but wouldn't state the religion that she had taken an interest in and for what reason. This is just speculation on my part, but you know, maybe it could have been some kind of demonic worship, and she was trying to gather them for their own use. I guess we'll never know. All right, Deb, what do you think of this one?
It's definitely twisted and sick. You might be right. She latched onto some sort of demonic belief, and unfortunately, her victims were kids. Do you know what happened to her?
No, I don't. Because her victims were kids, I didn't even bother to see if she was committed, put in prison, or what. I'm done with her at that point.
Okay. Well, hopefully she got some help or she's never getting out of wherever she is.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. So, but that one was, like I said, when it involves kids, I kind of get to the end of that when I'm done with it. So,
yeah.
Well, folks, with that being said, let's bring this one to a close. And we have a pretty good one for you next week. So until then, when we have another tale yet to be told. Thank you for listening. And remember to like and share the show. We would also appreciate a 5-star rating wherever possible to help new listeners find the show. We welcome all questions or comments you may have about this or any other episode. And our contact information can be found in the show notes of this episode. You can also follow us at foreverparanormal.com. And if you'd like to support us, you can buy me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/foreverparanormal. The links to these are also in the show notes of this episode.